Coming up in this episode...
A plantation grows one, maybe two things, right? It has an exploited labor force.
That's this fantasy of a racialized group of workers with no rights, who have no legal rights to protect themselves from exploitation.
This is the kind of capitalism, when you remove from the equation any responsibility to uphold human dignity.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB. I'm Orlando Montoya.
And I'm Peter Biello. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. Orlando, I promised you on this podcast some time ago more about the Civil War. Today, I'm going to deliver on that promise.
We have nothing more to say about the Civil War. It just keeps producing books and books and books.
And will for time immemorial, I'm sure. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of aspects of it that have Georgia connections. This is a podcast about books with Georgia connections. So, yeah, we're going to end up talking about it. This is going to be the last one from me about the Civil War for a while, I think. Even, you know,
you say that.
I know, right? Well, even our most dedicated listeners may say, another one? Come on. But like, so this one, I wouldn't even say it's fully about the Civil War. It's about something associated with the Civil War, and that the Civil War is mentioned quite a bit in it. But it takes a broader view of this thing that is associated with the Civil War.
What is the thing?
The plantation. Plantation.
Big house.
Yeah, the big house. That's what this book is called, right? It's called In the Shadow of the Great House, A History of the Plantation in America. It's by Daniel Rude, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of Georgia. He lives in Athens. And the title suggests something that we think of when we think of slavery and the American Civil War in the South, right? The great big mansion surrounded by huge fields where exploited people toil all day long doing very hard work for someone else's benefit, for no personal reward for themselves.
But this is not about the columns and the architecture. This is going to be about something bigger than the house.
Yes, it covers the evolution of the concept of the plantation over centuries, starting in Sao Tome, an island off the coast of Africa, where the Portuguese basically transformed this island into a sugar factory. It's just got one thing going on, sugar, and it's grown using enslaved labor Africans. And they try to bring as much sugar to market as possible. I spoke with Daniel Rude at the Atlanta History Center about his book. And during our conversation, he summarized the plantation ethos this way.
That's this fantasy of a racialized group of workers with no rights, who have no legal rights to protect themselves from exploitation. And this sort of dream of an ever-expanding consumer market with this drug crop. And that gives them the sort of energy and incentive to entirely transform the landscape of Sao Tome. Because,
of course, in the early pages of this book, he describes how a revolt on Sao Tome, essentially, you know, the enslaved laborers destroy the sugar-making infrastructure at this island. So, of course, what happens is not that the Europeans say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be exploiting people and producing crops this way. They don't decide it was a bad idea. What they decide is, let's just try this somewhere else, right? And so they replicate the model far, far away in North America.
So this book is an economic study in part?
Yeah, in part, it's sort of a critique of capitalism. I mean, you could argue that this is the kind of capitalism, when you remove from the equation any responsibility to uphold human dignity, which, of course, right? I mean, look at human behavior writ large. Human beings will behave in ways that harm other human beings if they can make a profit. I mean, that's a story told time and time again.
Well, you know, we could, you know, talk about, you know, economic systems all day, but getting back to the book a little bit, you said that the history of the plantation meant just simply moving this idea of Sao Tome to somewhere else, and that experiment failed?
Well, yeah, when a given experiment fails, they kind of move on and try the same thing elsewhere with different kind of, maybe it's a different crop this time, but we'll get into that for sure. I just want to slow down before we get too far, though, because there is a comprehensive definition in this book for what makes a plantation a plantation.
Well, I wanted to talk about that because when I was down on the coast, I remember the first time I visited Hopewell Broadfield Plantation, and I looked at it and I said, this is just a house.
Yeah.
What makes it a plantation?
Yeah, more than just a house. In fact, he describes in this book that over time, especially in colonial America and early America, the houses got farther and farther away from where the actual farming was done, in part because, you know, the owners of the enslaved people were worried about a revolt where they would die, you know, so they moved themselves away from it. But getting ahead of myself a little bit here, in Daniel Rude's book, he talks about 10 points that kind of make a plantation a plantation. And they're too numerous to go through here, but they're worth checking out if you read the book, and I hope you do. A plantation grows one, maybe two things, right? It has an exploited labor force, not necessarily slavery, but exploited. It depends on a worldwide market, right? In the sugar island, for example, Sao Tome, shipping sugar to Europe, you know, and it also simplifies the ecology of a given place. Those are just a brief summary of what it is. There's more to it. We'll get into it, but you can get down in the weeds. But yeah, take one crop, exploit some people, ship everything elsewhere. And that essentially is the bare bones of a plantation.
So it eventually comes here. Get us to the United States.
Yeah. Well, after Sao Tome, Europeans went to islands like Barbados and Jamaica. Those became plantation economies as the colonies grew. Of course, there are rice plantations on the South Carolina coast. There's tobacco in Virginia. Cotton plantations take hold sometime later. We'll get to that. Another defining quality of plantations is that because they grow one or two things, they are dependent on other places for everything else. So if you're growing sugar in Barbados, for example, you need wood to build those facilities. You're not farming trees there so you can build your own facilities there. And you're also not growing food to feed the workers who are doing all the work. So you have to import that. And Daniel Rude says that the growing plantations in warmer climates were a huge benefit to, in particular, colonial New England.
In fact, one of the reasons that colonial New England becomes a going concern and doesn't fail economically in its early years is because it is providing Barbados and later Jamaica with all the kinds of things that oddly specialized, narrowly focused society doesn't make for itself, like its grain, like its food, like all of its wood, all of its animals. New England's own economy is sort of drawn in kind of like a Caribbean hurricane spinning in the West Indies that sort of draws New England's economy into its orbit. And so again, because of this dependence on these faraway places, the plantations themselves are always really strongly impacting places that often like to think of their own histories as separate from the plantations and from the enslaved people who operated them.
So bringing it from Africa to the United States, now to Georgia, I know from my Savannah days that Georgia was founded there, specifically as anti-slavery colony. Not only that, but it also, James Oglethorpe wanted Georgia to be a refuge for the poor.
Right.
And he actually did not like this idea of predominant plantation culture. So how did we get it here?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, Georgia was founded as a place where slavery was not allowed. It was a place where large land ownership was not allowed either. And so it started as an anti-slavery experiment. But in those early years, as I mentioned earlier, South Carolina plantation owners were making boatloads of money with rice plantations, using enslaved black people to make that huge profit. So people in Georgia who were being told to follow the small farm model weren't making a lot of money, but they're looking over the border to South Carolina and getting very jealous of the wealth generated there.
There, of course, comes a group of dissidents who take on the name of the Malcontents. They are sort of middle-income English settlers who had enough money to pay their own way to England, but didn't have a big fortune to bring with them. And they start lobbying and appealing and complaining to the Georgia government. Look, the colony's failing. We have all these opportunities. They actually complain about, have not the liberty of getting Negroes, excuse the language. They have not the liberty of getting Negroes. I think that idea that they viewed themselves as having an inalienable right to the ownership of black workers is something that we continue to deal with throughout American history. That idea that they don't have freedom until they are able to make someone else a slave is really important, that their own rights are being impinged upon and they're being oppressed by the fact that they're not allowed to oppress others. They tragically win the day.
And so with the expansion of slavery, plantations begin to form in Georgia.
And so when we talk about the expansion of slavery, that gets us to the Civil War. Bring us now to the Civil War, which was what we were talking about.
It'd be a small part of this conversation, I promise, but a worthwhile part. So another feature of the plantation that Rude talks about is that it's a consumer of land. consumer of resources, and cotton is a big part of that. So because cotton really sucks the nutrients out of the soil, I did not know this about cotton, you can use that land for a little while, but then, you know, you got to expand, you got to find new land, or your cotton crop is just not going to grow as well. So this book makes it explicit exactly why Southern plantation owners needed to expand if they were to remain part of the United States and not secede. They literally would have died if they didn't expand into new territory. They simply couldn't be content, like Lincoln wanted them to be content with just, okay, you keep slavery here, the rest of us will move forward and expand the country without slavery. And that was just, you know, a death sentence to the South, in ways that, you know, perhaps Northerners couldn't understand back then because they weren't cotton farmers. Cotton farmers needed new land and they needed slave labor to not go belly up, essentially.
So the Civil War ended slavery, but not the plantation.
Right. Yeah. And that was in part because of the failures of Reconstruction. I mean, the 40 acres and a mule that the government offered or had promised formerly enslaved people just never came to pass. Former enslavers were forgiven. A lot of them were given their land back. And they set up, you know, along with anti-black laws, sharecropping systems, which kept formerly enslaved people in poverty. And so that's not to say the planters were doing as well as they were doing before the Civil War. Everybody was doing kind of poorly, but the plantation model was roughly the same, but the labor rules changed. And that's kind of the story through the 20th century as well, which we'll get to. I mean, the same can be said for chicken producers in Georgia. I mean, we know now, right? We have a lot of chicken farmers here in Georgia. And
it can be called chicken plantations.
You know, that's kind of what he's saying here in this book, right? He devotes chapters to this about how, you know, sort of chicken farmers become indebted to the people who sell them or rent them the equipment. And so the labor is, you know, you wouldn't call it slavery. It's not slavery, but these people are deeply in debt to the people who are buying the product that they are working so hard to create. So it's also, there's also time spent in this book showing how some of these Southern plantation owners went to California and created the same kind of plantation economy there, but the labor force were people from south of the border. Who
gold plantations.
I don't know. He didn't really talk about gold, but he did talk about how irrigation and other farming techniques sort of made more land available. And then, of course, the labor force, people south of the border, Mexicans who didn't have the same political power or legal rights to sort of defend themselves against the exploitation of the owners. They would sort of come for a season and then get sent right back.
Well, now that we're sort of expanding our idea of plantations, I'm thinking a large thing that only does one thing. A lot of people feel that it doesn't concern the neighbors. I'm thinking data centers.
Yeah, data centers are sort of part of this new wave of what you could call the plantation kind of ethos, the way plantations operate. And of course, global
That's
economy.
That's going to be controversial.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But I mean, it makes a whole lot. It comes at the end of the book. So by the time you're reading through all these definitions of plantations and you see how the idea manifests, right, like, by this point in our conversation, right, it's pretty clear that we're not talking about giant houses with columns, even though that's on the cover of the book, right? We're talking about a system of labor and land management to some extent, and how people are treated and how goods come to market. So when we're talking about the AI boom and the data centers that are driving that, it's one more thing about plantations. They spring up possibly on the ruins of previous plantations. So are these data centers in Georgia, for example, or in Virginia being built on places that used to farm cotton? I honestly don't know that, but it could be, right? But there's a bigger story here, like large companies like BP are investing in sugar plantations in Brazil in part to produce ethanol.
There's a lot of expansion going on, and a lot of that expansion is going on because there's a lot more demands on our electricity grid because of artificial intelligence. So you have companies like Microsoft buying their own nuclear power plants in Pennsylvania. But as we know, these kinds of corporations, unlike older planters, are smart enough to hedge their bets, and they're investing in all different kinds of sources of energy. And one of those is plantations in Brazil. And even though it's powering our own super high technology artificial intelligence, you still, as late as 2022, had migrant workers within Brazil being forced to work on these plantations and still cutting cane by machete as their enslaved forebears did four centuries prior.
All right. I'm looking at it. It's a very, very big book. So convince me that this has the narrative edge.
Well, it's a well-told, well-researched story. And frankly, it's a little spicy. I mean, in previous guests we've had on this program, thinking Leslie Stainton, who wrote Scarlet about her family's history owning plantations, and she referred to them as slave labor camps. Now, to some extent, they were that. But this book, in a way, describes how it didn't have to be slave labor, right? And if you take that idea out of it, that it had to be slave labor, what then is a plantation going to look like today? It makes you think a little bit about whether this part of the economy ever really left us or just changed. And I think he proves pretty definitively that it's still with us. It's just, it doesn't look the way it used to look. Mm-hmm. And that to me is fascinating. Like, giant corporations are now in the game. They're building portfolios. Maybe not every part of their portfolio looks like a plantation, but companies that we are very familiar with might have some plantation-esque facets to it, which is really interesting. It's not like one guy with a house in Virginia anymore, right? It's a company. It's a board of directors overseeing that kind of thing. So for me, that's great. And one thing I like about this book, just the way it's told, I mean, some historians are pretty straightforward, right? Like, just the facts, like, here's what's going on. And that's what he offers. But he's also highlighting, you know, here's how this group of people profited, and here's how this other group of people suffered. Like, he's not leaving the humanity out of it. He's really taking a clear-eyed, no BS look at how people were harmed by this. And I think, for me, that meant a lot.
Well, I'm glad to hear that part about that. Well, the book is called In the Shadow of the Great House, A History of the Plantation in America. Peter, thanks for sharing it with me.
I was happy to, and thanks again to the Atlanta History Center for hosting my conversation with him. It was really nice to speak with him in front of a crowd of people who appreciate history.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.